Good morning, everyone, and you're all very welcome here. Welcome to the people sitting in the pews and to everyone joining us via the web camera. I hope you're all keeping well. And to those who listen in at a later time. On Sunday last, a member of this congregation called Yvonne Fitzgibbon Dunn died. Now, I know many of you won't know Yvonne, but our last coming of age, her daughter was part of that. And Yvonne spoke here in the church. But shortly after that, she became ill. So we haven't seen that much of her around the church. But she was just 52 when she died. So can we just please stand for a few moments' silence to honor Yvonne? Thank you, everyone. We begin with our opening words. Come into this house of worship. Come in, bring all of who you are. Rest and quiet your work-worn spirit. For you are here to touch again the eternal springs of hope and renewal. Calm your hurried pace. For this hour, let the cares and fretfulness and worry of your life be set aside. Forgive yourself, for you are so worthy of moving on, of making new efforts, and of trying again. Know that you are not alone. There is strength and caring and support for you here. We are a community whose only doctrine is love. Let us enter into this sacred space and this sacred time. Our chalice lighting. At this hour, in towns and cities, quiet places and in ornate sanctuaries, Unitarian congregations are joining to light their flaming chalice. As we light our chalice today, let us remember that we are part of a community of faith and love. May this flame inspire us to fill our lives with the Unitarian ideals of love, justice, and the search for truth. We have our first hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 39, Bring, O Morn, Thy Music, hymn number 39.
Thank you.
Let us pray. God of our hearts, Spirit within, be among us now, connecting us where we feel no connection, stirring us to the love we find so elusive. We meet in your name and in the name of noble values and high principles. Help us to be true to them, for too often we are not. Help us to know, recognize, and admit our failures, the times when we judged unfairly, the times when we have hurt instead of healed. Help us to be big enough to be sorry, to take the path of reconciliation when pride and obstinacy have driven us apart. Help us to rise above our pain and recognize the pain of others. God of our hearts, Spirit of our deepest values, guide us and connect us. This we ask in the name of all messengers. Amen. Shohi shakthan na gwaelga so guihamid le keela an pather a hur an vunig isiduing. Or nahar, a thor nav, gonefer danam, gudaga the riacht, gonenter the hull erantalav, maraninter nav. Or naron le hul, tur doing anew, agasamat doing ar viacna, marawaha midna dar vekuna fein. Agus naglig shin I gahu, ach seir shin o alc. Mar is latsa an criocht an cocht is an dlor, thri seil na seil. Amen. Our reader this morning is Paul.
Morning, all. You may remember this time last year, Carl Cannon, a member of our congregation, and my closest friend died, and Bridget did a most beautiful service for him in this church. And I thought it was an appropriate time to read something about friendship. And his friendship, of course, was something I valued beyond. This is a wonderful book called Spiritual Literacy, which many of you will know. And one of the things that's said in it is, relationships provide the fastest and clearest way to see shadow parts of ourselves. To have a friend bring our flaws and failings into focus can be liberating. And another little piece here by Lewis Meads talks about commitment. And he says, not even mutual admiration is by itself enough to keep a friendship alive for long. For one thing, we discover somewhere along the line that even people we admire have feet of clay. The best of us is flawed. Our flaws show through eventually. We disappoint our friends, and sometimes their disappointment hurts enough to wound our friendship. Or even worse, we may discover that the traits we so much admired were put-ons, cosmetics hiding a shabby interior. And we cannot count on any friendship to survive the feeling of being conned. Besides, even friends who admire each other a lot drift apart when one of them moves to another part of the country. If I move away, don't see my friend again for 5 years, and do not stay in close touch, our friendship is likely to die of malnutrition. With dignity, maybe, and peacefully, but with the same result as any dying. I may still admire him or her, but I would admire him or her as a person who used to be my friend. I feel a good deal of melancholy when I think of it, but it is true that we cannot count on mutual admiration to make friendships last forever, any more than we can expect friendships to last because friends like each other or are useful to each other. If friendships like these do happen to last a lifetime, it is probably because they are more than friendships of affection or usefulness or admiration. Most likely, they are held together because the friends are committed to each other. Louis Meade's Spiritual Literacy. Thank you.
We have Sunday Club today, and we have children in the building. Can we have children to the front, please, for a story? Hey, Michael. Hi, Lena. One or two more coming. Two more. Another one coming down. Isn't this lovely to have lots of children in the church? Do you want to come and sit down? We'll just tell our children a story. And we're not even remotely scary. Hi, everybody. It's lovely to see you, and thank you for being here. This is a once upon a time story. Possibly didn't happen, but we tell these stories because they're interesting. And it's stories about mountain climbers. A group of mountain climbers went out. And you know when they're going to climb up rock faces, they often join them. Yeah, right, a big rocky mountain. And they were joined with the ropes, you know, between them.
Yeah.
And they had a great time in the mountains. And they absolutely got very engrossed in what they were doing. And they didn't really notice the weather changing. And instead of being lovely and sunny and fine, it became very cold and very cloudy and misty. And really, they were foolish for allowing that to happen, but it did happen. And they decided, look, we've got to get off the mountain really quickly. And they were coming down the ropes, being as careful as they could. But one of the climbers at the very end missed his footing. And he is attached by a rope, but he felt himself fall off the mountain. It's falling down really quickly. And he just thinks, I am going to die right now. This is dreadful. And as people say about someone, his life flashed in front of him. But suddenly, he stopped falling. The rope held, right? But he's left dangling in the air. The mountain's in front of him. He's dangling there. The mist has become very thick. It's very cold. But he's quite a religious person. And guess what he did? What his next move was? He's dangling there. Can't see anything.
He thinks it's God.
He thinks of God, absolutely. And he says most a fervent prayer he's ever said in his life. He says, oh God, please, please save me. I don't want to die now. And he thinks he hears a voice in his head say to him, yes, you're going to be saved. I will save you. He said, cut the rope that's holding you. Now, what would you have done if that was you hanging on the end of that rope? You wouldn't have cut the rope. You wouldn't cut the rope. Would you cut it? Would you have? Would anybody have cut the rope?
No.
You'd have cut the rope. That has to be one always. Well, the next day, he didn't cut the rope. He held on really, really tightly. He thought, this is the only security I have. I can't cut this rope. The next day, the mountain rescue team go out, and they find the man. And he's died of the cold. And when they found him, he was still holding on to the rope. And they say, oh, the poor guy, if only he'd realized he was only 3 foot from the ground. Had he cut the rope, he would have been saved. So that's something to think about. He might have landed on his feet, but he might have sprained his ankle, but he would have been alive, at least. He might have hurt his ankle, but wouldn't it be better to have an ankle in plaster than being dead? Yeah, he'd be like that. Who's taking Sunday, love? Bella. That's great. Thank you very much for your attention, children. You're absolutely terrific. We're going to have our second hymn, and it's hymn number 194. We're not familiar with it. I'm told that it's very odd, but Josh said it's strange. We're unfamiliar with it. Josh will play it through, and then we will try to sing it. For my reading, I've chosen a piece. It's by Gordon Linney from his series Thinking of New in the Irish Times. This one dates from September 2008. When Nelson Mandela was freed from prison in 1990 at the age of 71, he had served 27 years of a life sentence, much of it in hard labour on Robben Island. The world has since come to love and respect this great human being because of his lack of bitterness and his determination to work for a new South Africa, one that was at peace with itself. Henry Kissinger, the American statesman, described Mandela as a great leader because he was someone who could lead his people to a place where they had never before been. He was referring to Mandela's success in turning his people away from violence to seek peace and reconciliation with those they had once considered their enemies. A crucial component of that change was Mandela's awareness of the power of forgiveness. In several speeches after his release, he astonished audiences with his emphasis on the need to forgive. Mandela said, "We especially should learn to forgive each other, because when you intend to forgive, you heal part of your pain. But when you can forgive, you heal completely." As Africans, we have suffered in terms of slavery and colonization for a long time. Forgiveness has remained our best cultural heritage. Mandela has given proof to the world that forgiveness, a core Christian principle, makes sense and it works. It worked for him personally and worked for his country. It could do wonders for this country too, with its too long memories of past injustices. There are several examples in the teaching of Jesus to show the need to forgive. It is a defining characteristic of the Christian faith. The Gospel of Matthew says, Peter asks, "How often should I forgive? As many as seven times?" Now, Peter was being generous because at that time, many would have held that to forgive three or four times was more than enough. But Jesus goes farther, much, much farther, and tells Peter there's no limit. 70 times seven, he says. In the Lord's Prayer, Jesus taught us to pray for forgiveness. "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." These words are so familiar to us that they're often we overlook the truth. As William Temple reminds us, only one petition in the Lord's Prayer has any condition attached to it, and that is the petition for forgiveness. This implies that when we say we forgive, we take our own salvation into our own hands, because whatever God does in this respect depends on what we manage to do. If we cannot forgive, we will not be forgiven. We have all been hurt at some time in our lives, and probably been instrumental in hurting others as well. When we are wronged, it is often easier to retire into self-pity or anger than find a way to deal with the situation. This is because our instinct is to retaliate and to punish in the mistaken belief that to forgive is to condone. But forgiveness does not condone what is wrong. Nor does it mean forgetting what has been or done or said. Rather, it means no longer allowing the offence to make a difference or to control our actions. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the other great South African, offers this advice. "When I talk of forgiveness, I mean the belief that you can come out the other side a better person. A better person than the one who has been consumed by anger and hatred. Remaining in that state locks you in a state of victimhood, making you almost dependent on your perpetrator. If you can find it in yourself to forgive, you are no longer chained to the perpetrator. You can move on, and you can even help the perpetrator become a better person as well." Tough words. Now we're going to have a time of prayer and contemplation. So I want to start off by just getting into a quiet place. And I'm going to read these words. They're from Native American Indians. And it's talking about the circle of life. "Have you noticed that everything an Indian does is in a circle? And that is because the power of the world always works in circles, and everything tries to be round. All our power comes to us from the great sacred hoop of the nation, and as long as that hoop is unbroken, people flourish. The flowering tree is at the center of the hoop, and the circle is the four quarters. They nourish it. The east brings peace and light, the south warmth, the west rain, and the north brings the cold, mighty wind that gives us strength and endurance. Everything the power of the world does is done in a circle. The sky is round, the earth is like a ball, and so are the stars. The wind whirls. Birds make their nests in circles. So their religion is as ours. The sun rises and goes down in a circle. The moon does the same, and both are round. Even the seasons form a great circle in their changing and always come back again to where they were. The life of a man is a circle from childhood to childhood, and so is everything where power moves. Our teepees were round like the nests of the birds, and they were always placed in a circle, a nest of many nests where the Great Spirit meant us to hatch our young and watch them grow. All life is a circle.
Thank you.
title of this morning's address is The Limits of Our Horizons. And what I've been thinking about is that how we think of life has been linear, starting with the Big Bang, coming up to today, and that we mark it out and measure time. And that, as the other reading said, life isn't like that. It is a circle. And we see only a small arc of that circle. And we need to be careful about what we pronounce to be true about the small arc we see. Throughout the history of religions, every culture has developed some form of religion. Religions try to provide answers for the mysteries of life. They may try to regulate the behavior of its members. They try to answer what is unknown, for example, the origins of life and our destiny when we die. And even though religious leaders might try to deny it, religions evolve. They change because of the passing of time, because of new knowledge about the world, or perhaps in response to the influence of a charismatic leader such as Jesus or the Prophet Muhammad. We tend to forget Jesus never founded a new religion. He developed new thinking about his Jewish faith. And the originator of the Islamic tradition, the Prophet Muhammad, explicitly said that his teaching was the correction of errors that had developed in accounts of God's revelation to Abraham, Moses, and all the other prophets. He said errors had crept into Judaism and Christianity, and Islam is meant to be the correction of those errors. The great Western religious traditions trace their origins to Abraham, and we can, at this distance, trace the developments in them, changes in them, and the splits that occurred in them systems. When Pope Benedict died recently, he was hailed as a great defender of the truth. That's what he dedicated his life to, preserving his version of the truth. Benedict's truth was Catholic teaching. But I don't believe that there is a single identifiable truth that is forever fixed and unchanging. Everything is relative. For example, if I were to take a gun and go outside and kill someone randomly, I would be guilty of murder. But those waters are very easily muddied. If someone is ill and in pain, do I withhold pain relief because it may shorten that person's life? We can take that a step further. Our Western lifestyle, that is the way we are living, is causing the deaths of thousands of people in many parts of the world because of climate chaos. So are we murderers? Truth is depicted in the stained glass window to the front of this church. It is left of centre, vital, but off centre, because there's no ultimate religious truth. Our human story is always going to be a work in progress. We work with what we know now, knowing that that will change in time. Humanity itself is still a work in progress. I think we have to be careful about declaring something is or isn't the truth. A truth I was taught as a child was I was born to know, love, and serve God on earth and be happy with him forever in heaven. That knowing, loving, and serving God meant that I was to follow the rules of a particular Christian denomination. At death, I would be judged, and consigned to reward in heaven or down to hell for punishment. And that is depicted in all sorts of Western art. It doesn't ring true for me any longer. Part of me says that if God is just, he wouldn't impose those sort of rules on people who didn't happen to hear a version of truth. I see all religions as solution to the human curiosity, the longing to understand the world. We humans create our own version of God's. But two great threads flow through all religions, and these threads are the longing for love and an absolute need to feel that there is justice in the world. Two great human longings. And I think children of a very young age have that need for justice. How often do you hear children say, but that's not fair? We need love to flourish. And when we live in love with one another and in harmony with the earth, we experience a sense of being at home, of living out our true nature. We stop all the questions. Life becomes easier. Unfortunately, it's also human nature that we are easily distracted from that better nature. It is spiritual practices or religions that draw us back to living in love. You know, we're like children. Somebody rattles a new toy in front of us, we get distracted from the good living. Which religion is the right religion? Well, the right religion is the religion that works for you, the one that makes you more loving, and the one that fulfills your sense of justice, the one that satisfies your truth now, knowing that that may change over time. The Christian premise that this life is a once-off test with reward of heaven and hell, that was more acceptable when it was the belief that the earth is just 6,027 years old. Now, I come up with that figure of 6,027 years old from a professor of Bishop. He worked in Trinity College, and he worked out the age of the earth by looking at the Bible, by his knowledge of the Bible. So if you were thinking of the earth in terms of being just over 6,000 years old, and that God was the guiding force throughout most of that time, it's easy to accept that. In this version of the human story, God was a continuous present guiding his people through all that time. Now we know that the story is far more immense. We know only a minuscule part of that story. The knowledge of the shortcomings of some religions has made religion almost irrelevant in Western culture. Western culture at this time does not feel the need for God. And I wonder if that is a good or a bad thing. You cannot impose religion on people. But together with that lack of religious belief is a growing sense of alienation and isolation among people. The monotheistic concept of punishment or reward after death fulfills our desire for justice. You know, people go into their just reward in heaven or to be punished if they're nasty. We need to believe that goodness is ultimately rewarded and that the evildoer is punished. The longing for justice is also provided by the concept of reincarnation, which is part of the Eastern philosophies. Other faith systems and other world systems have this belief. and I am beginning to feel more at home with the idea of reincarnation. When I say that, I'm also aware that I probably have a very simplistic idea of what that involves. Not quite as simple as some people, though. I was told that when Saville Hicks was minister at this church, and Saville Hicks was here between 1910 and 1962, and he preached about reincarnation, and when one of the nearby Christian churches heard of this, they poked fun at that lot down the road who believed that the doorknob would become a person. But, you know, you say no, but maybe in time, but a lot longer time than we envisage. I do believe that death is not the end of the story for humans. The survival of some part of us after death is supported by the laws of physics. One of the laws of physics is that no energy is created in the universe, nor is any energy destroyed. This scientific law confirms that at death, the energy that comprises each one of us is not destroyed. It may be that we may live many, many lives. And as I have said before, if you think that would be wonderful, oh, I'd die, but I'll be back again, you know, let's go around one more time, as Josh played on the music for us. Remember that the life you have now is one of privilege. Most of the world do not enjoy the privileges we enjoy. Maybe next time it mightn't be so comfortable for us. This universe is much greater than ourselves. We perceive a fraction of the whole and we understand less. The lack of understanding means that we cannot set the truth in stone. We must keep aware of how ignorant we are. There's an old saying in Ireland that I remember learning at school, Imean Nadina Akfana Nakanik. And that translates as, people go, but the hills remain. That is only true in the short term. Over time, mountains grow, and then mountains arose. And we don't realize that. We think the mountains stay because of the limits of our vision. I recently watched a program about the geology of Ireland, which made me realize how we think in terms of time being linear, when in fact everything is a circle. We think it all started with the Big Bang, and everything was very woolly for a long time, and now we have discovered everything, and we can measure time in hundredths of a second, and that's all our imagination. Life is not a line, it is a circle. And somehow the Native American Indians intuited that. When I do a funeral service, I often talk about, I don't tell people they're going to heaven or hell, but I do say that I thought life continued. And I quote Thich Nhat Hanh, who said that, look at the leaves on the trees. In the summer, they're lovely and soft and green. In the autumn, they become brittle, they fall from the trees, we say they're dead. However, within a few years, those leaves are broken down by the wind and the frost and the insects and worms, and they are the nourishment the tree uses to produce new leaves. It is a circle. But that's taking a very short view of what actually happens. It is true, but it's a very short view. There is a wider one that is much, much longer. If you Google, where is Ireland, you will be told that it is 53.7798 degrees northern north of the equator and 7.3055 degrees west of London, and that the Atlantic is to the west of us. Ireland was born south of the equator. It has moved to where we see it now. It is still moving. The Atlantic Ocean is about 150 million years old. Its life, too, is finite. One day it will die. One of my favorite places in Ireland is the Burren. And the Burren was formed, it's limestone, so it was formed from dead shells, from fish that died many, many millions of years ago. But right now, the rain and the weather is dissolving that limestone. The particles are being brought down into the ground by the rain. They're being washed into the sea. They make their way eventually. But those particles are nourishing shellfish off the west coast of Ireland. It is a great circle. It is greater and more wonderful than our imagination. Remember, we see life with a very limited horizon. So we must be open to question our truths, no matter how dearly we hold them. But the most important truth we know right now is that the most important thing to do is that we love one another. And if we love one another, the circle of life confirms that eventually that love and care and loving one another will come back to us in time. Amen. We're now going to have our third hymn. It's hymn number 23, Bring Many Names, and we're going to have our offertory at the same time. fair trade tea and coffee served down in the Damer after the service. Do please join us. There's some copies of Oscult magazine on the table and copies of the Inquirer. Tomorrow evening at 7:30 via Zoom, there's a meeting of the Managing Committee. Wednesday, there's a lunchtime service of reflection, 1:05 to 1:35. That's available in church and online. There's a box on the table for donations during Lent. I think we're out of the habit of making charity collections in this church, but the box is there. The money will be donated to Christian Aid after Easter. Sunday, the 26th of March, we're going to have a book sale in the Damer Hall. So between then, if you bring in books that you have finished with, it's going to be a win-win situation. You will clear out some of your books and you'll get bargains of new books. And the money is going to the restoration fund for new lighting in the church, lighting that will be more eco-friendly. In May, when the weather is going to be lovely and warm, we'll be having our sale of plants. And again, the money is going to the restoration fund of the church. But I need butter boxes on the table that size or bigger. Any sort of a box, or the containers you get some veg like tomatoes in, bigger ones like that. Small ones, shallow ones, not good. Deeper ones like that, great. And this is to make it really eco-friendly, that the plants are grown down the road. You're going to take them home, plant them in your garden, and have lovely flowers at the end of it. For your diary, the AGM of the congregation takes place on Sunday, the 23rd of April, after the service. Now, Madeline would like to say something, and as she makes her way up, I will just make one more announcement, and that's on the 2nd of April. There's going to be a book launch in the Damer Hall after the service here, and this is by somebody who used to be an advisor to the Catholic bishops in England, and his book is called The Search for Jesus the Jew. It's in the church after the service. Is anyone interested? Madeline has news of another book launch.
Another book launch, just to, for those who like to read. 9 years ago, I launched my first novel here in the church, and I thought I'd do the second one a year or two later, and eventually I've got there. So you're all invited on the 25th, it's yesterday fortnight, to come here at 6:30 for the launch of Revisited Sins. There's a glass of wine in it for everybody, and I hope I can make it into a bit of a special day, because this is an independently published book, not in the bookshops. This is your chance to get one. And if I can say to the people on the web, it is on Amazon. I'm sorry, I know people don't like Amazon, but you can get it. It's called Revisited Sins. My name is Madeline A. Stringer. And if you don't buy it, Jeff Bezos won't be the slightest bit unhappy, but if you do buy it, I'll be extremely happy. And I hope you'll be happy reading it too. Thank you.
Will.
Thanks, Bridget. Sorry, 2 seconds. Just looking at the rota. My name is Will, and I look after the rota for here, and I thought I would take the opportunity, as there are so many people here today, to say that we need people to join up the rota just to help with a few things, bringing flowers, welcoming at the door, or doing coffee downstairs. And I see, for example, that on the 2nd of April, which was mentioned, there's nobody doing coffee, and there are some people who are doing coffee all the time. And they enjoy it, and thank you, Janet. But anyway, just to say, I'll be downstairs. If you want to grab me to have a chat about any of the tasks that need doing, I'd be delighted to fill some of the gaps. And the next reader to come up here and read like Paul is needed on the 23rd of April. So anyway, it's just a general call out. If anybody feels like volunteering to do some of the jobs, have a chat with me downstairs. Thanks, Emil.
I know there is a tendency to be shy about volunteering to do things, but if a few people are doing everything, it becomes onerous. But when lots of people volunteer, it becomes something that's just not too often, and everybody enjoys it. And no one will leave you doing a job you can't manage. You know, if you're doing coffee, you're not going to be sent on your own to buy the coffee and do everything. You'll have a help, and everything will be explained to you. Our final hymn is hymn number 140, Hail the Glorious City, hymn number 140. There is a power at work in the universe. It works through human hands. It is a creative, sustaining, and transforming power. It will sustain us whenever we take a stand on the side of love, whenever we take a stand for peace and justice, whenever we dare to take a risk. Trust in that power. Amen.